Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next this next item will really kind of kick off what we're going to be spending our time on tomorrow at the workshop that we have scheduled with Craig Shin, who has appeared before us numerous times in the past, more recently related to the his work with the Family Forest Land Owners group. So welcome you in this capacity as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Chair. And this is working. Is the lapel mic working? Not at all.
It's I think it's working.
It's working. Yeah. The question is whether you can hear me.
We can hear you.
Okay, great.
I guess, can people in the back hear? Yes.
Okay. So first of all, thank you for allowing me to be here. And I want to take just a moment to thank all of you for your service. I know something about serving on boards and commissions, and this kind of work is a hero's work. So thank you. Thank you for the service that you provide to Oregon and her forests. I also want to take just a moment to thank the staff of the Oregon Department of Forestry, which also does heroic work, and all the people who care about Oregon's forest. We've heard this morning from a set of different people who, while represent some disagreeing views, all care about Oregon's forest. This is a good place to be to consider the things that are before you today and tomorrow. Professor Lash and I were asked to kick off essentially the discussion that you'll be spending the day on tomorrow by talking about wicked problems, science values, and policy. And I'm happy to do that. And so just a moment about who I am. I'm emeritus professor. Let's see if I can get this to actually work. And what that means to me is that I get to do what I want to do. And not do the things I don't want to do. So I'm here today because I want to be. A couple of other things about me that you may or may not know. One is that I've spent over 30 years in the academy working with mid-career professionals. A number of you know me by that work and the different kinds of degrees and programs that I've been involved with, as well as the plethora of professional development, education, and training programs that we run out of the Center for Public Service. What that means is that I've had a lot of experience working with people who are trying to implement, trying to govern, and trying to create policy in environmental and natural resources. For over 25 years, I led those areas of work at the Hatfield School of Government. Jennifer Allen, who many of you know, now takes that responsibility on. But you may not know that I was trained my first degree as a forester back in the days when that was the degree. If you wanted to be a recreation specialist or economist, you took the one class in those fields. I worked as a forester and for a number of years led biological research in forestry. So I was trained as a positive scientist in forestry. And as Chairman Imeson alluded, I have interacted with the Department of Forestry and the Board of Forestry in a variety of different ways, most notably probably chairing the Committee for Family Forest Lands, and then chairing the Large Fire Review Committee. I thought we'd taken care of all the fire issues. One of the lessons that I think that I can say that you might take away from what I have to say is that the challenge with wicked problems is we don't ever solve them. We get to readdress them over and over and over again. And that's disconcerting to people like me who like to solve problems and then put them in a drawer and have them be done. But the things that we face just don't have that kind of architecture. So the summer I turned 14, I decided that I was going to spend my life healing the relationship between humankind and the land. I'm almost done with that work. Not at all. That's the great good thing about a passion or a vision like that, is that it allows you to have good work every single day. Oops. This was supposed to be a smarter slide. Okay, so who am I today and how am I speaking to you about the things that I intend to speak to you? My terminal degree is in resource sociology. My wife always tells me she knows that it's going to be a long night when we're at a cocktail party and I introduce myself that way, because that's not something that people think about very much about. And yet, if we talk about a forest hydrologist or a forest engineer, people don't have very much difficulty becoming associated with what that means. So just a takeaway, my interest intellectually is how it is we produce and create meaning in society about the things of nature, and then how we arbitrate the differences among those meanings, because they aren't uniform, particularly in a pluralistic society. So the tensions you felt in the morning, presentations by comments to the board, and even in the board discussion, that's where I like to spend my time. So a couple of notes about science, policy, and law from a sociologist perspective. One is that science is a particular way of creating meaning in society. We reify it, and certainly professionals, like resource professionals, use it as a place to stand. But it is canonized by a set of conventions. And within that, the kind of knowledge that we produce, then we share some assumptions about in terms of its truthness, but it's constructed. I want to remind you that I'm trained as a biophysical scientist and as a social scientist. I believe in science. Second, law. I stand with Philip Selznick, one of the great sociologists of our time. Who talks about law as the formalization of social norms. And in a rule of law society, that is not trivial. The process that it takes for us to create statutory law, but also policy, and in a progressive and populist state like Oregon's history, boards like yours create this law. Policy is this kind of middle ground where we create agreement about what it is we're going to do and what it is we're not going to do in the governance settings in which we act. And so what that means is that instead of bright lines, these things are drawn with magic markers. And the meaning that we share about them is always under construction. So here are some things that sociologists, resource sociologists, can say for sure. You can disagree with me, I suppose. But I'm always asked whether we have anything to actually say, because when I get done with the kind of introduction I just gave you, it sounds like it's all relative. So what we know for sure is that what you hear about the issues that you're dealing with depends on who it is you hear from. And in the systems of governance that we have, you don't get to hear from everybody all the time. So there's always this question in a representative democracy of who it is we're hearing from and who it is we're not hearing from as we try to divine the common wheel interests, which are our responsibilities in positions like yours. What I can say for sure is the work that you do is political work. And most of us didn't sign up for that. You know, most of us signed up to not do that. In fact, I think the reason I went into forestry was because, you know, I could heal the relationship between the humankind and the land without dealing with people. It sounded like a really good way to do that work, you know. We arbitrate differences. That's what small p politics is about. And in the American political economy, we do it both in the marketplace and in the political arena. Ours is a commercial republic. That's the way it's designed. And these are leaky systems. They are not separate. That makes it challenging for us, people in your positions, to kind of have a sense about where the public stands. Multiple arenas for doing this work, and they're not mutually exclusive. What do I mean by that? If I were giving a different kind of talk, I would talk to you about the 90,000 governments within the United States, one federal government, 50 states, a few odd territories, 573 federally recognized tribes. If you're doing your subtraction, there's still a lot of governments left. So there are about 27,000 general purpose local governments, counties, cities, towns, and then there are some 60,000 other governments, special districts. And that includes fire protection associations and a variety of other kinds of things that litter the landscape. And what that means is that there's not one place to do political work. There are many of them. And that's one of the reasons that things don't seem to stay settled. And then finally, one thing that I know that we can say for sure together is that agreement at one scale in society does not ordain agreement at another level. So if we create agreement in Wallowa County or in Deschutes, it doesn't mean that we're going to have agreement in Grant County or Multnomah County. Even more to the point, if we create agreement at the state level, there's no reason to believe that that will reflect the kind of agreement we would generate through good political work in one of those other junior arenas. If we went to Coos, we would not get the state recipe. That's called the ecological fallacy in science. But it's something that's hard for us to remember because we think we've done good work here. And then when we go out and talk to people in another part of the state, it turns out they aren't of the same mind. And that's this truth, is that wherever the community, wherever that polity is, and the governance structure that's associated with it, we have to actually do new political work to come to agreement. Okay. Was I almost okay with that? Okay. So my charge is to talk with you a little bit about framing wicked problems, some ways to address decision-making in terms of the architecture of decisions, and then some ideas for how it is we come to agreement. This grows out of two things that I wrote. If you would like the long version of these, both of these are available. This one I co-wrote in 1994, Rural Resource Management, Problem Solving for the Long Run. The genesis of this are three chapters about decision makings. The first one is when you're in charge. The second one is when we're in charge. And the third one is when no one's in charge. And I've spent the rest of my life since 1994 working in the arena where no one's in charge, or many of us are in charge. This was back in the days when I thought that mathematical modeling of decisions would help answer this. And I made a lot of money consulting on that basis, by the way. But it turned out that that wasn't the case. It turned out that what we really needed to do was address the value propositions that underlie the decisions that we make. This book is hot off the press. It's an accumulation of three authors that have spent their life doing the kind of work that I am. I'm one of them. And summarizes approach to what we describe as new public leadership. It's framed on the notion of new public governance, where we operate in a power-shared world, in a world in which we're chronically underfunded to deliver the public goods and services that society wants, and the list goes on. So there's a long version to this. A couple of things that come out of this that are worth looking at. One is, publicness in politics. One of the characteristics about public service leadership, when you step into the Board of Forestry and fill these roles, you take on a public service leadership role. So it's more than your private life and your private role, and you know that. But it's important to remember that, and that publicness creates a messiness about the work that we would like to be tidy. Second of all, we spend a lot of time in this book talking about leadership and followership. What would leadership be without followers? And it's a reminder that in the work that we do, both in representation and in administrative positions, paying attention to what those around us need in order for them to follow is important. And finally, the book is chock full of a set of tools around conciliatory practices and prudential judgment. We actually have a website vehicle that actually makes these available in kind of two-page forms as tools for doing this kind of work. What's important here is that if you agree with the argument that I made when we started about there not being bright lines, it means that we send the people that do our work, like the staff at the Oregon Department of Forestry, into their world with direction but with discretion. And so the question is, what do they pay attention to? I can tell you in reviews of large fires, an awful lot of the discussion ends up right around that point. The discretion that folks have in incident command structures to do the work that we ask them to do. And it's impressive how often they get it right. And then we spend a lot of time talking about when they don't. And so this book spends some time focused on that. And out of this, I want to draw some of the things that we address. First of all, that the new normal is a wicked problem world. And so I want to spend some time talking about that. And here are some different visions. For those of us that are trained with degrees in natural resources, in my generation, we were still coming to terms with what ecology meant and the notion of webs rather than straight lines. And what I can tell you is that, well, that is now ubiquitous in natural resources to think about webs in terms of natural systems. We are just beginning to represent that in governance systems. So there's a new literature that's maybe 10 years old on network governance, for instance, that helps understand the kind of multiple potential patterns for authority in these shared powered worlds. So think about something like fire in Oregon's landscape. Who's in charge? Well, by the time we got that list put up, we would have, you know, a blackboard full of different folks that are in charge. Private landowners have some responsibility. Oregon Department of Forestry has responsibility. They have special responsibility with BLM because of an agreement. Forest Service has a different set of the list gets large in a hurry. And so network governance takes that as a given, and we're beginning to theorize about what that means in terms of how we operate in that kind of world. At the minimum, wicked problems are by their nature multifaceted, and that's what the other one represents, a little pathway in this. You can think of wicked problems. The morning was a palette of wicked problems, from fire to implementing riparian rules or water quality rules, and here are a couple of others. Trust in government is always an interesting wicked problem, but you can make your own list. This is not a new idea. It's an idea that has a heritage. When people present scholarly articles about wicked problems, they usually start with Riddle and Weber, a couple of people writing and planning that says that they're inherently wicked, ill-defined, and reliant on political judgment. They're never solved, but must be resolved over and over again. Akoff, who wrote on decision-making for years, says what decision-makers deal with today are messes, not problems. Mess is a set of external conditions that produce dissatisfaction. And then Donald Schoen, who's one of my favorites, says policy is a swampy lowland, where solutions are confusing messes incapable of technical solutions. Doesn't that sound exciting? It sounds troubling. So here's an illustration. This comes out of Gareth Morgan's effort to map the electrical power systems in Toronto. Here are at least three characteristics. One is that wicked problems are polycentric. They're interrelated. You can't do one thing without doing many things. And the border is problematic. Again, one of the great gifts of most positive science is we get to have a clear boundary about the problem, its definition, and then we can approach it with a set of tools that we know about. The challenge with wicked problems is that before we get started, we have to figure out what the boundary is, and the boundary is problematic. Okay, this one, one of my colleagues, Doug Morgan, was elected to the Portland School Board, and he said, oh my God, that was a bad idea. It turns out that the challenges that are faced there are not unlike the mix of problems that you face, and this is a map that we drew for one of his set of issues. Where the school board was increasingly being asked not only to do education work, but deliver health services and social welfare services. And so the education focus, which is what he thought he was signing up for duty on, turned out to be obscured by a suite of other kinds of things. Like your time with the Council on Environmental Quality, where you know you think you sign up for Department of Forestry duties and forest policy with the state of Oregon. It turns out you're spending your time on water quality issues. Not surprising because they're closely related, but these problems leak networked, interdependent, polycentric, complex, indeterminate, and with high ambiguity. I want to unpackage those last ones in just a minute. John Gordon and Joyce Berry, in a little book they wrote about environmental leadership, started by talking about environmental problems. And what they said is that this is the world in which we act, long times to solution, complexity, weak or scattered science base, let me come back to that, a need to integrate across disciplines, emotionally charged with uncertain and unintended consequences. And this is normal. This is normal. Okay, so from my perspective, here are some things that stand out. Complexity, economic, political, and social, as well as ecological. We can unpackage each of those, and I would be happy to spend some time on that. I've talked some about the political structure and the challenge of governance. Social structure is complex as well. One of my doctoral students was talking to me yesterday. She's working on capacity on rural communities and urban communities in the nonprofit sector. And after a year and a half of research, she's discovering that she needs to redefine rurality. I'm not quite sure what her answer will be, but it's clear that the tidy definition that she started with is not serving her purpose in terms of understanding the differences that she's seeing in those capacities. Interdependent, we've talked about this. One of the bedrocks of environmental and natural resource sociology is the notion that the landscape is humanized, that this is, that people are a part of the landscape and we can't separate those systems. Indeterminance. So John Gordon, who those of you who know him, is a scientist's scientist. And John and I think maybe the first time I ever addressed the Board of Forestry, John was chair of forest science at OSU, and I was running a research unit for Crown Zellerbach. And we came to the Board of Forestry for the board to get on board with setting up a series of research cooperatives on things like nursery culture and tree improvement and alder. The potential of alder in the landscape. So that was a few years ago. John is still a scientist, and we have conversations about this with some regularity. One problem with betting on science is that science never catches up to the questions that we have in front of us. So it always takes us some time to frame it, put the science in place, do the science work, generate the results, interpret that, and there's always a lag time. That doesn't mean it's not valuable. It is. But it's never going to be enough and never going to be quite in front of us in terms of where we want to be. Also, quite often, by its very nature, when we do analytic work, we decompose the whole and we look at a part of the problem. And then in policy terms, we ask you to put that all back together again and make judgments about the whole rather than the parts. So we have great data on three reaches of streams, one on the coast, one in the near Cascades, and one on the east side. And then we say, on the basis of that science, we would like you to make judgments about Oregon's landscape. It's not a bad thing to have that really good data on these three watersheds, but it's not going to get you to the place where you need to be. Also, quite often, because of the nature of how we do our work within disciplines, even when we do transdisciplinary work, it's quite often true that we leave a bunch of stuff out in order to be able to look at particular dynamics that we're interested in. And then we have to put those back into whole systems. So John and I are in agreement that even when we have robust science in an area, it's not complete. Ambiguity. I would like to spend all day on this. One of the challenges that we have in the world in which we do political work is that we have ambiguity about what we care about. We know from political science survey work that when we ask people questions about their preferences in different locations, in different social settings, we get modestly different answers. They don't move from one end of the spectrum to another, but they move. They are contextual. And we know that whenever we do that kind of work, that people will give us answers, whether or not they can give us good answers or not. And when you do this kind of work, I think it was you, Jim, who said, you know, when we went to the field, we had some really good evidence and it was a good day. In our work, it's so important to go to the field so that we can look together at what it is and see what a change in shade percentage means in terms of what we visualize about that stream. In the abstract, we have one set of ideas. When we go out and look together, we actually have the potential to share an understanding about what that looks like. More importantly, the things of nature have multiple meanings at multiple times. I just built a wonderful fireplace mantle out of a piece of timber. I suspect because of the vertical grain Douglas fir that was embodied in that piece of wood, that thing would have been a mighty fine big tree in another context in which some folks would have some different values ascribed to it. And I would probably ascribe some different values to that in a different place at a different time. So there are all kinds of reasons that we have difficulty coming to agreement and sustaining agreement over time. And part of it has to do with ambiguity. Okay. So questions for me? This is your time. I'm in your service. If there are things that you would like to ask me, please do. This is kind of a frame for Wicked Problems, a short introduction to it. It could be longer. I'd like to shift gears and I'd like to talk for a moment about some decision framing and why it is decision framing gets away from us so often in terms of how we think of, we should approach decision making. Is that fair? And Chair, you can tell me when it's time to quit. Maybe if I had 10 more minutes or so, that would be okay. See if we can't catch up a little bit. I've done a lot of work with decision making, and as I told you earlier, I actually did a lot of formal decision making and mathematical decision making, and we reduced that to back of the envelope techniques, and we've been working on those for some time since. And here's the genius of that. And that is that most of the work of decision making is not objective. I'm going to just let that sit for a minute. For some of you, that's heresy. For others, it sounds just right. The problem with decision making is people. And if we could just exclude people from the decision making, then it would not be very problematic. But we have to let people in. So here's the model. Well, most of us are technical trained and depend on science to build our stock of knowledge. At its core, problem solving is subjective in nature. So this model is one that I'm going to spend some time drawing some pictures on. But what this says is that you have a set of alternatives across one side and criteria across another. Is this familiar? I mean, we use this regularly. And most of the time, we don't spend very much time thinking about what this says to us. So first of all, the choice statement, choose the best alternative, is subjective in nature, a priori. Even when we're given legislative direction, it's subjective. Just because somebody else told us what we should do doesn't mean that it's preordained or it's somehow objective in nature. It has object-like qualities, and the more agreement that we have, the more of a social fact it begins to sound like. But a priori, there's nothing that says that we have the right decision statement. It's subjective in nature. How about criteria? We love to get those into measurement, you know, board feet or pounds of carbon sequestered, right? But those measures are just conventions that we've created to create empirical accounts for the things that we care about. Criteria are simply values reified. And the more agreement we have on them, the more object-like they are likely to appear. That is not very problematic for us. But they should always be something that we think about, and it shouldn't be surprising if they're contested. And that isn't even asking the question about which criteria are appropriate for the kind of problem that you're addressing. So what makes it on that list and what not, and what does it mean? So let's decide we're buying a car and we decide that fuel efficiency is important. So we decide to use a conventional measure, miles per gallon, and we decide that what we'll do is use the EPA sticker value of miles per gallon. What does that mean? Is that a good thing to have mileage go up or go down? It may be that if you're interested in carbon emissions, having that go up so that you have more miles per gallon is a good thing. If you're selling fuel, you might have a different view. It might be that you'd like that to go down so that you can sell more fuel. So even when we agree on the measure, we can disagree on the direction that it has value for us. So that's pretty interesting. And most of the time, we try to reduce this number to a finite number, 3, 5, 6, 10, and something less than 112. And then we usually bundle them. And we use all kinds of conventions to cue us about what that bundle is. And just as a reminder, those are constructed. And if we have agreement about that construction, that shorthand can serve us well. But quite often, we are packaging up political disagreements in those bundles. And then when we get ready to discuss alternatives, we discover that we've bundled up some things that shouldn't be bundled up together. And then alternatives. A priori, is there any set of alternatives that's complete or sufficient? You know, other than the do nothing alternative. This is the place of great creativity, but it's also a great subjectivity. And even if we have conventional alternatives that we have agreement about, there's a lot of room here. And there's room for invention of additional alternatives. So the final choice, when you get done with this, you have, if you're making a decision by yourself, what am I going to eat for lunch? You can have a set of alternatives and a set of criteria, and then you use sufficient information to make a distinction between alternative one, alternative A, alternative B, on the criteria that are most interesting to you, and you get to embrace the decision. When you're doing this as a group, it's a little more problematic, because when you get done with figuring out the effect of alternative A on criteria one, then you have to come up with agreement within the group about whether, on balance, alternative one has enough virtues to override B. Now, I can tell you from my work in mathematical decision-making that we have some conventions. We can add weights to these, and then we can add importance to these, and we can multiply, and we can reject everything we learned in eighth grade about common denominators, because the color of a car and miles per gallon of a car have no common denominator, except subjective expected utilities. And yet we do that kind of arithmetic all the time. I'm here to tell you that on significant issues, well, that can sometimes provide some direction, like straw votes, it's really worthwhile unpackaging things. So is there anything about decision-making that's objective? What can scientists do for us? Well, one thing scientists can do, social scientists can help us understand what people care about, so they can work on the criteria side to find out whether you've got the right things on that side. They can help you understand how many and how much of which kinds of people, where and when, care about that stuff, so that you can get some information about that. The powerful place for science is in the interior of this matrix. So the effect of alternative A on criteria one, that's wide open for conventional positive science.
Yes, and so we run into this problem, though, that then people argue about the effects rather than the values. So we it's science in there, but the values haven't left the process.
No, I certainly have. Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Yeah, but this is a place, where you can do more and better science, and it can help you out because you can see that pathway to effects. And quite often on those pieces, we actually have some good agreement about what the causal pathways are, which makes it more probable that we can actually create better determinations about what those pathways are. The problem is when we aggregate them again, you know, the common denominator problem is they don't add and divide. They violate the mathematical rules. We have to do that work. We can't escape that work. All right. So I could spend a lot of time on this. A couple of things that I would like to suggest is that whenever you hear somebody say, because alternative A is better than alternative B because, there's a value statement hidden in whatever follows. However they express that, somebody's science report, whatever it is that comes after the because, there's a value statement under there. And in your position as policymakers, you should listen loudly for what it is that follows the because and see whether it's captured in the criteria. If it's captured in the criteria, then we can actually have a discussion about what those trade-offs are. And that's what we end up doing. Another thing is, and I'm stealing some of my colleagues' thunder here, is the power of and. At the end of the day, there's nothing wrong with adding another alternative that is a mixture of some components of the others. And you do that all the time when you negotiate about outcomes. But we can actually think about that as an architecture for improving what it is we think we're doing. Okay? So I'm going to shift from this, and we'll just skip on that. My colleague Marcus Engel says wickedness is the new normal for public leaders. I have a corollary to this. The rejoinder is that in a wicked problem world, leaders identify problem types for followers and make ordinary as many problems as possible. One of the great gifts of our world that's socially constructed is we routinize an awful lot of stuff that would be very problematic. And that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. So I was listening to the discussion this morning about the fire finance pickle that you're in. And you know, there are parts of that that are wicked in nature, but there are parts of that that are ordinary in terms of staffing up to do the kind of billing that needs to be done. And that's really important work for us to sort out the nature of the problem and then use appropriate techniques to address the challenges that are in front of us. That just sorting out is really an important thing to pay attention to in the challenging world that you work in. That there is an awful lot of what we do that has a routine to it. And if we can, and if it's appropriate and we can put the problem in that box, then we have a lot of techniques to deal with that. And that's a gift for the people that you're charging with delivering public services, whatever those are. Okay. So, which direction is this going? All right. So, I've already talked about some of this. So, science-based decision, what does that look like in natural resources? Professor Gordon and I were talking about this just the other day, and we were reviewing the number of times that he or I have called for science assessment panels or been impaneled into science assessment teams, where the structure of these is that people in your position who have policy decisions to make lob over a doorway a set of concerns that you have and then ask a panel of scientists to give you their best judgment on the canon of science that we accept. And that's a very standard procedure these days for dealing with this space in which there's wickedness in their nature, because science quite often doesn't have a study on point. Where they do, we use that. But increasingly, this notion of asking panels of scientists to make judgments about the world in which they work and what it is they know in service of policy questions. And thinking about that and how you use science assessment panels is worthwhile. Another is thinking about the architecture of the science that you support. As an old hand science manager and research manager, one of the challenges is always to make sure that we're doing enough science that is we expect to fail, that we're out in front of some things that we know is not going to give us the results because it's too much on the frontier. We don't have a sharp enough definition. We're asking people to look at dynamics that are not well understood. And that's hard for us to invest in. And yet a portion of the science that we do needs to be there so that when we have new issues, we have a trace, a pattern of science starting. And another is to make sure that that science comes in ways that has high credibility. And there are a variety of different techniques for doing that. But thinking about the way we use science and making sure that we don't expect science to do political work for us is important. Okay, we've already talked about why field days work so well in decisional groups, and I wanted to spend a couple of minutes as we close on some tricks of the trade. I'm sure that you'll spend some time on this in your workshop tomorrow. These tricks of the trade come out of a short course that Steve Greenwood and I are teaching called The Foundations of Collaborative Governance. It's a graduate certificate course that we're teaching, combining the competencies of the National Policy Consensus Center with our Center for Public Service. So here are some tricks of the trade. Okay. Pretty cool. All right, keeping track of what people care about. So I've told you about this, that little matrix, one of the cool things about that is that you can actually keep track of what people care about on the criteria side. And when I work with groups or chair groups like this group, I actually actively do that. I actually keep a running tally of things that I think I need to make sure are on the criteria list so that we can move forward together and do good political work. We still have to do the political work, but we can do it better if we actually know where the contest is. This is really important. Three times this morning before I started speaking, I heard people talk about both sides. It's pretty easy for us to see ourselves in a both sides world. Both sides. The solution to climate change is cutting no timber. The solution to climate change is cutting timber. Both sides. Here's the trick. Bend the line. Instead of seeing it as a tug of war, put them orthogonally. Radically changes the room for outcomes. Radically changes the room for outcomes. Okay? I mean, you still may be stuck down here, but parties on this side have nothing to lose by letting people on this side go all the way up there. Right? If you're stuck down here, you can go all the way out there. A little bit of room in this direction creates an amazing amount of decision space that you could never get to if you were in this tug of war or a teeter-totter or whatever you use for your war analogy. Radically transforms the decision space. The next tool of the trade, moving northeast. I grew up in New England. Went to school at the University of Maine. So Northeast is a good place to be. For those of us that were trained as surveyors, we know which direction Northeast is, right? This is Northeast, right? So every little increment that these folks move this way creates more space. And these folks move this way, creates more space. So if we can move Northeast, we increase the room that will allow us to find solutions in which we have higher agreement. That's kind of cool. So anyway, tricks of the trade, bend the line, move northeast. Another is better solutions rather than best. If I'm correct, the wicked problems are never solved, but we have to readdress them over and over again. Rather than spending our time honing the best solution, the optimal one, the only one, the one that will solve everything. And we should work on a pathway that gets us along that direction towards better solutions. And as long as we're moving in that direction, you know, we'll get a chance to come back on that pathway and do it again. And then finally, the power of and in solution finding. When you find yourself saying either or, ask yourself what it would sound like if you said and in the middle. What would the and solution be in the set of alternatives that you were in front of you? And quite frankly, sometimes that opens up design for new alternatives in that decision matrix. So let's say that we were interested in workforce development and we were particularly concerned about doing that in ways that ensured that we had the technical capacity in the woods to do a range of forest treatments, from forest health to harvest. And solutions might look pretty different than whatever it is we're carrying around in our pocket. Okay? So I wanted to draw those because otherwise I spend a lot of time talking about them. And I think that that gets me pretty close. These are all tried and true. Again, I'll stop here, and I just want to thank you again for your service. I know the challenge that this work that you do represents, and I know that your service on this committee is voluntary, and I want to thank you again for stepping up and filling this role, which is so critical for Oregon and our forests. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yes, I think they're constantly find a solution as an and solution, frankly, with the hope that that's what we get.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't saying anything very profound. We're just saying sometimes we define the solution, the board does, by what we want is an and solution. I mean, honestly, I think of our state forest work that way. The question whether that, and then that creates the challenge to try to get there. It is a wicked problem, I think, as many of the ones who get to us are.
So, again, I was asked to kind of tee up this arena. I could also spend some time talking about the challenges of implementation in a power-shared world in deference to policy agreement. Part of what you're reaching for there is just getting to an end solution isn't sufficient, particularly when we're chronically underfunded and we right. don't have the staffing and we don't, yep. et cetera. And so in the new public governance world, one of the things that we spend a fair amount of time talking about is what it looks like when we're trying to implement right. these in across the political economy in a power shared world. So.
Okay, if we're gonna take a very brief break, like a target a 5 minute break to save a little time here. So that means Apple time, it's at 10:55. Those of you who don't have Apple, you know,